The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic, Parade Magazine, and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to continue with part two of our five-part series. And this is We Are Here, the cover story found in the July 2022 issue of National Geographic. Writer Charles C. Mann explores how North America's indigenous nations are reclaiming their sovereignty, and that includes control of their land, laws, and how they live. Last week in Chapter 1, we learned about how the Tililiokiat of British Columbia were reclaiming the land, and that includes some parts of Montana. Today, we read about the Chanta of Oklahoma in Chapter 2, which is titled, Let the Games Begin. The first time I tried to use Ishtabuli sticks was at the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma's Labor Day Festival, the biggest official gathering of the Chata, as they call themselves. Held in Tuskahoma, the nation's capital, it's in some ways like any county fair, and in some ways not. One of the biggest knots is Ishtabuli. A team sport older than any played by their colonizers, Ishtabuli is called stickball in English. Each team puts 30 players on a soccer-like field with a 12-foot post at each end. Every player has two sticks, always handcrafted with the wood bent over and lashed into a loop at the end. The loop has leather strips that form a pocket, barely big enough for the small leather-covered ball. Using only their sticks, players carry, pass, or shoot the ball. Hands aren't allowed. Each side tries to hit its goalpost with the ball while preventing the other from doing the same thing. Few rules limit how the players can do this. When some Chata acquaintances at the festival tried to teach me how to catch the ball, I could barely do it. One of the few times I was successful, they rushed me. I looked up to see four guys with sticks charging in my direction. And did I mention that the game is played without padding or helmets, and that some of the people play barefoot? The guys plowed into me. One reached out a hand to help me up. "Now you're Choctaw for today," he said kindly. "You ready to play?" said another. In the old days, the game was played in the open countryside, often with hundreds of players on each side. Entire communities gathered. Competition was so intense that Ishtabuli is known as the little brother of war. It was sometimes used to settle disputes. Some of that rowdiness is still present. Games stop for little but jump balls and injuries. The crowd yells and bangs drums as people collide on the field. When players catch the ball, opponents pile onto them. "I'm not sure I'm ready to play," I said. The Chata homeland was the fine bottomland of Mississippi. After Europeans arrived, Chata leaders played Spain, France, and England against each other, trading with all sides and creating prosperous farms and ranches. The nation's first decades with the new United States were largely peaceful. The Chata even allied with it against Great Britain and its native allies in the War of 1812. The great Chata leader, Pushmataha, was commissioned as a brigadier general. Despite their alliance, the Chata became, in 1830, the first of more than 40 nations forced to leave their homelands and move to what was then called Indian Territory, now Oklahoma. Their journey inaugurated the famous Trail of Tears. In return for ceding their land, the Chata made one crucial demand, sovereignty. In the treaty, the U.S. promised that no territory or state shall ever have a right to pass laws for the government of the Choctaw Nation, and that no part of the land granted them shall ever be embraced in any territory or state. That promise was not kept. In the next few decades, much of the new Chata homeland was parceled off to other native nations. The rest was converted from communal to private land and distributed to tribe members who were often strong-armed into selling it to settlers. In 1907, Indian Territory was incorporated into the new state of Oklahoma. Indigenous nations outside Oklahoma faced similar losses. Today, the average reservation is 2.6% of the size of the original homeland. Not only did the government go after tribal land, it also went after the tribes themselves, setting dates to terminate them as legal entities. The Choctaw came within a whisker of termination. Other nations weren't so lucky. If there's a single beginning for the turnaround in Native America, it may be the passage of the Indian Self-Determination Act in 1975. Pushed through by a wave of indigenous activism, it created mechanisms for tribes to establish and, most important, direct their own programs. It meant bringing back Choctaw dance and Choctaw language, which had been suppressed by missionaries. And it meant the first openly played games of Ishtaboli in decades. The game had been forbidden in the old Indian schools. All the while, nations across Turtle Island were fighting to escape state laws that restricted their actions after keeping them from having an economic base. After two legal battles that reached the U.S. Supreme Court establishing that Native nations are not subject to many local or state laws, Congress in 1988 passed a law that cleared the way for them to run gaming operations. Today, the Choctaw Nation has seven casinos in southeast Oklahoma and more than 200,000 enrolled members. The nation has become a powerful economic force responsible for almost 100,000 jobs, and it's rebuilding its land base, having bought some 60,000 acres. With the income from their casinos and businesses, the Choctaw construct roads, support schools, put up clinics, and build homes for their elders. They have erected 17 community centers, one in almost every town in the nation. Sovereignty is at the basis of everything we do, Sue Folsom, the cultural project manager for the nation, told me. Folsom supervised the development of the new cultural center, which opened last year. One of its most prominent exhibits treats the contentious history of the Choctaw and the U.S. government. It's called Protecting Our Sovereignty. Now, some additional background to the Choctaw story comes from the captions of some of the photographs that accompany Charles Mann's article. These photographs, by the way, were taken by Kilia Yuan. In one of them, we are in a gaming casino. Boy, this thing is something else. Lots of purples and pinks and lots of slot machines and other gambling devices. It says the Chickasaw Nation owns and operates the huge Windstar World Casino and Resort in Thackersville, Oklahoma. The nation has 31 casinos and gaming operations that help pay for, among other things, education, housing, and health care for its 73,000 citizens, as well as the salary of its ambassador to the United States. We turn to the next page, a couple of photographs. First, we have from Muskogee, Oklahoma, Principal Chief David Hill, at the forefront of the fight that led to the landmark McGirt versus Oklahoma decision in 2020. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Muskogee reservation still exists legally, which led to similar recognition of tribal lands for five other Native nations in the state. Next, we go to Cherokee, Oklahoma, and then, of course, the question is, what does sovereignty mean to you? And the quote, sovereignty is the right for us to decide what we want. This from Sarah Hill, the Cherokee Nation Attorney General. The McGirt decision is a hot-button issue in the state, and Hill now spends much of her time wrestling with the consequences, including what it means for the Cherokee Nation's sovereignty. I tend to think about it in terms of not only preserving what was, she says, but the right to be a separate people with a separate destiny. For her, that means the tribe's descendants creating their own future. People took away Cherokee children for a century, putting them in boarding schools so they could become what others wanted them to be, she said. And then there's another caption, one of which is right beside a picture of the kids playing stickball. Boy, that looks ferocious, by the way. Anyway, sovereignty reaffirmed is how this caption is headlined. And we read, in the 1830s, the federal government forced members of dozens of nations to resettle in Indian Territory, which became part of the new state of Oklahoma in 1907. A landmark Supreme Court decision in 2020 reaffirmed the existence of the Muskogee Nation's reservation based on its 1833 boundary treaty boundaries. And then that recognition of tribal land has been extended now to five other nations and Oklahoma. So, it's quite an interesting story there. Next time, in part three, we're going to hear about the Karuk of California, not Oklahoma, and this is how they are renewing the world. Now, when you study U.S. history, you do gain insight into the struggles of Native Americans. Our next article, written by Dana Hedgepeth for The Washington Post, appeared in the September 27, 2021 online edition of The News and Observer. It's headlined, "This Was the Worst Slaughter of Native Americans in U.S. History, but Few Remember It." Now, her story will take us to Idaho. And I'm going to add the story contains some graphic details because it is a very horrific story. Historians consider it the worst massacre of Native Americans in U.S. history, yet few have ever heard of it. The Bear River Massacre of 1863 near what's now Preston, Idaho, left roughly 350 members of the northwestern band of the Shoshone Nation dead, making it the bloodiest and most deadly slaying of Native Americans by the U.S. military, according to historians and tribal leaders. The Indians were slain after soldiers came into a valley where they were camping for the winter and attacked, leaving roughly 90 women and children among the dead. The death toll, historians say, exceeded some of the country's most horrific Indian slayings, including the 1864 slaying at Colorado's Sand Creek, where 130 Cheyennes were killed. And the death count was nearly double the roughly 150 Sioux killed at Wounded Knee in South Dakota 4 days after Christmas in 1890. Now, some accounts put the Bear River death toll even higher than 350. In one account of the brutality, Danish immigrant Hans Jespersen, in his 1911 autobiography, said he walked among the bodies, counting 493 Shoshone Indians dead, according to a 2008 article in the Salt Lake Tribune. Jespersen wrote, "I turned around and counted them back and counted just the same." Historians said roughly two dozen U.S. soldiers died at Bear River. "It's almost annihilated us as a people," said Darren Perry, former chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation, "but it's largely been forgotten." Many historians say the biggest reason the Bear River slaying was lost or ignored in history lessons is because its carnage was eclipsed by Civil War battles, which were raging at the time, according to Charles Peterson, a historian at Utah State University. He said it's ironic that it received so little attention, given the well-known Native American woman, Sacagawea, who was Shoshone, and most famous for having served as a guide to explorers Lewis and Clark across the West. Jonathan D. Dice, a military historian based in Washington, compared the slaying of Native Americans in the 1800s to mass shootings in the 21st century. "People became numb to them," Dice said. "People considered Indians not really humans," Dice added, "so it was easy to justify killing them or mistreating them." The Shoshones were once a nation that had 17,000 people that included several bands that stretched apart across parts of Nevada, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. They traveled with the seasons. In early autumn, they went to Salmon, Idaho to fish. In the spring and summer, they'd go to Utah to gather seeds, berries, and roots. When cold weather hit, they hunkered down in the Cache Valley, which runs through northern Utah and southeast Idaho. The willow and sagebrush in the valley helped protect them from the wind and snow of winter blizzards in the Big River, a boa ogei, as the Shoshones called it. It had an abundance of fish, plus the area was rich in wild game. In the 1800s, the Shoshones and other tribes faced a slew of hardships and troubles as the U.S. government wanted to rid the country of what officials called the Indian problem. Settlers moving west and Mormon farmers invaded Shoshone land, and miners caused skirmishes as they passed through on their way to the west to find gold. After the Civil War started in 1861, President Abraham Lincoln sent regiments from the 3rd Regiment California Volunteer Infantry in the Union Army, who were stationed at Fort Douglas near Salt Lake City, to help protect the mail routes and telegraph lines that ran through the Cache Valley area. But many of the troops were frustrated that they were there and wanted to be on the front lines of the Civil War. On January 5, 1863, 10 miners traveling south on the Montana Trail were said to have been murdered by Indians. A day later, a group of white men headed to Salt Lake City got lost and were allegedly robbed by Indians. In an argument about returning some livestock, a white man named John Smith was fatally shot. A judge issued a warrant for some of the Shoshone men who were accused of killing him, with orders for U.S. Army Colonel Patrick Connor to effect the arrest of the guilty Indians, according to records from the National Park Service. By then, cold weather had set in, and the Shoshones were in their winter grounds for the season. When the spiritual leader told of a dream where Indians were killed by soldiers on horseback, about 50 left and went to another site, but many stayed with Shoshone Chief Sackwich. "How can you move people in 4 feet of snow to anywhere you couldn't be followed?" Perry said. On January 29, 1863, Connor's unit of almost 300 infantry and cavalry came down a frozen wintry bluff into the Shoshone's winter camp. That morning, Sackwich got up early. He saw steam from the mountains and realized as they got closer it was the horses' breath in the cold air. Sackwich told his people he was going to try to talk to the military leaders, and he ordered his warriors not to be the first to fire weapons, according to May Perry, who was a great-granddaughter of Sackwich and wrote about the massacre. Sackwich thought the colonel would ask for the guilty men, and he would hand them over, wrote May Perry, who was an activist and tribal historian. He told his people to be brave and calm, wrote May Perry, who died in 2007, was Darren Perry's grandmother. But the colonel didn't ask for the men before his soldiers started to fire. In his memoir, William Drannan, who was an Army scout, said they just started to fire. It frightened the Indians so that they came running out like jackrabbits and were shot down like sheep. The Indians had very few rifles, according to Darren Perry. They fought with tomahawks, spears, bows, and arrows. The soldiers pushed the Indians closer to the river. They flanked the Indians, Darren Perry said, and the river became their last resort. Some jumped into the river but were shot, and others were swept away in the icy current and drowned. Another Shoshone chief, Bear Hunter, faced torture after soldiers captured him. Whipped and kicked, he said he not a word, nor did he cry out, according to May Perry's writings. To him, she said, that would have been a sign of cowardice. Because he showed no fear of the pain, soldiers heated a rifle bayonet and ran it through his head from ear to ear, May Perry said. They wholesale massacred the tribe, Darren Perry said. Men, women, and children, they lost their lives. May Perry said her relatives told of how the blazing white snow turned brilliant red with blood. Some 150 Shoshone survived, according to tribal historians. Chased by soldiers with their baby strapped to her back, Anzi Chi, a Shoshone woman, jumped into the river and hid under an overhang along the bank, but she had a hard time trying to care for her own wounds and couldn't keep her baby from crying, according to writings from May Perry. She knew that if the soldiers heard the crying baby, they would both be sure to die. May Perry wrote, the only way Anzi Chi believed for one of them to live was to throw the baby into the river, and that's what she did. Chief Sagwich's 12-year-old son, Yeager Timbubu, whose Shoshone name, Dabuzi, meant cottontail rabbit, became caught in the gunfire and looked for shelter. He eventually found his grandmother hiding in a teepee packed with people, according to May Perry's writings. According to a website of the tribe's history, she was afraid the teepee would go up in flames and told him to lay very still. But Yeager raised his head and found himself looking into the barrel of a soldier's gun. Shoshone historians said Timbubu later told of how the soldier raised his gun and then lowered it twice, looking into his eyes. Then he put it down and walked away. After the massacre, Connor, the colonel who led the attack, told of the bodies in the field in a report he sent to the then U.S. War Department. He said he had destroyed over 70 Indian lodges and captured 175 horses. He noted that he left a small quantity of wheat for the sustenance of 160 captive squaws and children whom I left in the field. Catherine James Fisk visited the site months later and wrote, many of the skeletons of the Indians yet remained on the ground, their bones scattered by wolves, according to the National Park Service. Connor was promoted to the rank of brigadier general after the massacre. A Shoshone tribal history called the massacre a clash of two diverse cultures trying to share the same land, and the Shoshone lost. Ever since the 1863 massacre, the land where the massacre happened has been privately owned. At one point decades ago, landowners said they tried to plow the land for farming, but too often found human remains believed to be those of Indians. In 1990, it was designated as a National Historic Landmark, and May Perry and other Shoshones fought for decades to have it recognized as a massacre and not as a battle, as some historical markers had called it. The northwestern band of the Shoshone Nation bought about 550 acres of Bear River land in 2018. The tribe, which now has a population of about 560, plans to build an interpretive center to honor the history and those lost at Bear River. It's our place where our old people died, Rios Pacheco, a tribal leader, said, speaking in Shoshone in a video produced about the slayings. They were called by the army. They were killed by the army. Their spirits are still here, and we are still here, he said. Well, next, some lighter fare, and we're going to start with a question. What's on your bucket list? Get inspired by these people who made their travel dreams come true. This article appeared in the June 26th through July 3rd, 2022 issue of Parade magazine. It was written by Helen Hyken. And the first item is the ultimate national park road trip. When genetic testing revealed that Abby Whitaker carried a BRCA2 gene mutation that vastly increased her risk of breast and ovarian cancer, the news came as a shock. Having already survived anal cancer a decade before, Whitaker, 46, wasn't about to wait and worry. She made plans to have a preventive double mastectomy and reconstructive surgery, followed by a hysterectomy. But she also knew she needed something joyful to look forward to, so she decided to visit 20 national parks in 2021, interspersed with her surgeries. "Nature is my church. It's where I feel the best, and I wanted something really magical to hold on to," she says. Joined by her husband, Ty, she headed to the Grand Canyon and Death Valley in February, followed by the Petrified Forest and Saguaro in March, or Saguaro. The Whitaker kids, 15-year-old Ever and 12-year-old Eden, joined their parents on about half the trips, including a spring break road trip to visit Utah's Mighty Five, Zion, Bryce Canyon, Arches, Canyonlands, and Capitol Reef. Over the summer, they hit White Sands, Yellowstone, Lassen, Redwood, Crater Lake, Pinnacles, and Glacier National Parks. At Glacier, Whitaker had an epiphany. "We were driving the Going to the Sun Road, and it was just mesmerizing. And I thought, how amazing it is to be alive for this." Along the way, the family purchased a Sprinter van, something Abby had dreamed of for years. "Having a double mastectomy makes you do some impulsive things," she jokes. The Whitakers completed their odyssey with a memorable weekend in Yosemite, staying at the historic Awahani Hotel. "We saved the crowning jewel for last," she says. Next, Alaska in winter. Seeing the Aurora Borealis had been a dream of Marilyn Mastrella's since she first saw photos of it in high school. The clinical social worker from Somerville, New Jersey, 56, saw the Northern Lights twice on a recent trip to Alaska in Fairbanks, a prime viewing destination. "It was so amazing," she says. She also hiked with a herd of reindeer, soaked in a thermal mineral pool, and went dog sledding with a team that had been in the Iditarod. "Dog mushing was so much fun. The dogs were so happy and fun to watch," she says. Next, Mastrella plans to return to explore the state's national parks when they're not blanketed in snow. And finally, we have Petra Jordan, a wonder of the world. "I had been desperate to visit Petra for so many years," says Ann Swinford, 63, a radiologist from Ann Arbor, Michigan, about the site renowned for its ornately carved temples and tombs hewn directly into rose-colored rock. Founded by the Nabataeans in the 4th century B.C. and all but abandoned 1,000 years later, Petra became famous for its starring role in the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Swinford, who traveled with her husband Mo, was awed by the grandeur of the ornate structures hidden within the towering cliffs. "When you're walking down the long canyon and then the rocks split and you see the temple appear, it's so magical," she says. They also visited Jordan's historic sites, including the Roman ruins of Jerash, where the stones still show the grooves of chariot wheels, and the colorful city of Madaba, famous for its Byzantine mosaics. And she swam suspended in the saline-saturated waters of the Dead Sea. "Ever since I went to Bible class and they told me there was a sea you could float in, I wanted to experience that, and it was so much fun." So that's a nice way to fill your bucket list. Writer Sammy Magni of the Associated Press reports that Egypt now displays tombs found in Saqqara. Her article appeared in the March 20, 2022 online issue of the News and Observer. The dateline is Cairo. Egypt on Saturday displayed recently discovered well-decorated ancient tombs at a pharaonic necropolis just outside the capital, Cairo. The five tombs were unearthed earlier this month and date back to the Old Kingdom, a period spanning roughly from about 2700 BC to 2200 BC, as well as the first intermediate period, which lasted for over a century after the Old Kingdom collapsed, according to the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities. And just to put that in perspective, this is around March 19th of this year. Mustafa Waziri, Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities said Egyptian archaeologists started excavating the site in September. That would be last year. The tombs, he said, were for senior officials, including regional rulers and palace supervisors in ancient Egypt. All of those five tombs are well-planned, well-decorated. Excavations did not stop. We are planning to continue our excavations. We believe we can find more tombs in this area, he told reporters at the site. The tombs were found near the Step Pyramid of Djoser in the Saqqara Necropolis, 15 miles southwest of Cairo. Footage shared on the ministry's social media pages showed burial shafts leading to the tombs. Walls were seen decorated with hieroglyphic inscriptions and images of sacred animals and afterlife items used by ancient Egyptians. The Saqqara site is part of a sprawling necropolis at Egypt's ancient capital of Memphis that includes the famed Giza's pyramids as well as smaller pyramids at Abu Sir, Dahshur, and Abu Wishawash. Ruins of Memphis were designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site in the 1970s. In recent years, Egypt has heavily promoted new archaeological finds to international media and diplomats in the hope of attracting more tourists to the country. The vital tourism sector, a major source of foreign currency for Egypt, suffered from years of political turmoil and violence that followed the 2011 uprising that toppled autocrat Hosni Mubarak. The sector has recently started to recover from the coronavirus pandemic, but was hit again by the effects of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Along with Russia, Ukraine is a major source of tourists visiting the Middle East nation. So just a lot going on around the world, and it all somehow ties to travel, doesn't it? It's kind of an amazing thing. Well, to round out our journey today, I'm going to read from the July-August 2022 issue of the travel industry publication, Virtuoso Life. And this is an advertisement I wanted to share with you. It's titled, Submarines, Scientists, and Suites. Explore the Amazon, Antarctica, and Underwater Life on the new Seabourn Venture. Seabourn's first purpose-built expedition ship, designed to reach smaller, more remote ports, inaccessible, to larger ships. The 264-passenger Seabourn Venture hits the seas in July, and the sister ship Seabourn Pursuit will launch in 2023. Now, Polar-class designs make for smooth sailing from the Arctic and Northern Europe to South America and Antarctica, while suites with walk-in closets and plush robes wrap cruisers in luxe comfort throughout the journey. Woo! So, there you go. There's an ad for you. Have fun in the icebreaker and under the sea and all that. By the way, the North Carolina Relief Service invites you to attend our biggest fundraiser of the year, the New Visions Gala, celebrating a brighter future. This very special event taking place on Friday, September 9th, from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at the Raleigh Hilton North Hills. Join us for a fun-filled evening. It features our new vision showcase highlighting the latest technology for the vision impaired, and cocktail hour and dinner, silent auctions, music by Barbara Hinton, and a lot more. Tickets, $125 per person. Please RSVP by August 31st. For more information and to purchase tickets, call 919-832-5138. And that, my friend, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.